The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
All right, we're still looking at the call to apologetics, an apology, if you will, for apologetics, a defense of the defense. And today we want to look at the past. And in the days to come, we'll look at the present. Why do we look at the past? Well, tradition isn't the most favorite Protestant word, but it's a wonderful word. And we learn from tradition so much that is encouraging and a correction for today. And of course, apologetics, Christian apologetics, or biblical apologetics, has been there since the beginning, well, since the fall, to be exact. And but more specifically, and more germane to what we're doing today, since the apostolic age. And so what I want to do today is take a romp through 2,000 years of the church's response to the surrounding culture. The reason that we're doing this such a rapid survey is because we have courses at Westminster that actually break this apart into very rich and full segments and discuss the texts and so on. We have a course that takes 4 years to unfold in the history of apologetics. It's called Christianity in Conflict. The purpose today is simply to give us an overview and almost by force of the cumulative effect of some of these names and trends, just to see, just to taste the richness of what we in the church have been blessed with in the past. Okay, for our purposes, we have to figure out a way to divide the history of apologetics, and mostly for convenience, but also partly for reasons of historical accuracy. I like to divide it into three periods, quite unequal periods, but three periods of time which are characterized internally by very similar challenges and often by very similar responses. They are very simply pre-Christendom and then Christendom and then post-Christendom. And let's just explore those. Pre-Christendom, of course, refers to that group of centuries before Constantine's conversion and before Constantine turned Christian faith from an illicit or illegal religion into a licit or legal religion. Lots of controversy about how good that ultimately was for the church. And we can wrestle with that when we look at Christendom. But before Constantine, in the 4th century, early 4th century, there were various characteristics that apologetics had to wrestle with in the surrounding culture. It was the days after Pentecost, and when the last apostle died, the church found itself in a kind of diaspora. And following the Jewish diaspora, indeed modeling itself often after the Jewish diaspora, and with many Jewish converts, Christianity moved from that setting into the challenges of the time. And perhaps the two greatest challenges were one from without and one from within. From without, it was persecution. And persecution, of course, has been the characteristic of the surrounding culture in different waves and in different episodes since the beginning. And during the times of the Roman Empire, there was heavy persecution at times, and at other times, more relaxed. Roman government was both good and bad for emerging Christian faith. It was good in the sense that it provided an amazing network of communication. It provided highways and byways for those heralding the gospel to use as they moved into many different parts of the world, over to India, down to Africa. Just the spread of Christianity up into Europe was astonishing. And because of Roman law, one could occasionally appeal to the justice system in order to get a fair hearing. As you'll remember, many of Paul's own testimonies are before some kind of Roman magistrate, literally doing apologia, defense, getting himself off a charge in the name of Christ. What intellectually needed to be wrestled with from the external world was the surrounding Greek philosophy. How would a biblical faith become interfaced with a philosophy that had not only pagan but ultimately fairly skeptical roots, and yet which had glorious expressions such as Plato and Aristotle? Within, the church had to deal with orthodoxy. And with 2,000 years of hindsight, we now have a much clearer understanding of what mainstream Christianity ought to look like. We've had the advantage of the great councils, we have the creeds, we've had the Reformation, and we can be understandably exercised when even a relatively small part of doctrine is distorted. But when you think back to the first few centuries of Christian faith, then you realize that they were trying to assess the biblical data with a view to formulating it as orthodoxy. And so heresy was one of the major problems in the early church. It's still a problem today, but in those days it was a defining problem. The church had missionary zeal, there were ethical issues, and the gradual emergence of two different worldviews, Christian and pagan, took some time to develop. Let's consider briefly a couple of the figures that are crucial in this development. I mentioned last week Justin Martyr. Justin Martyr wrote the first and second apologies, masterpieces of early Christian apologetics. And he also wrote something called Dialogue with Trypho the Jew. It's an imaginary dialogue. Much writing in those days was done in a dialogue form, inheriting that from Greek culture and Greek academic teaching. And these three works are extraordinary testimonies to the way early apologists began to formulate their defense. One of the constant challenges to Christians was that they were accused of not being loyal to the surrounding society, civic loyalty. And indeed, parts of Christian faith were not conducive to civic loyalty. And so, nevertheless, as you know, from the biblical mandates to pray for those in authority, to pay taxes, to work with and in the culture without being of the culture, it was a job of these father apologists, as they were known, to explain the difference between a philosophy that's not conducive ultimately to the system that was heralded in Greek and Roman philosophy, and indeed very much channeled through the emperor's power, and on the other hand, the fact of great loyalty, even greater loyalty than many pagans who love to hide from authorities and not pay their taxes and so on. Addressed to the emperors Antoninus Pius and Lucius, the first apology is a plea for fair play. I read an excerpt from it last time to show you how this works. Justin wants an honest investigation, as befits a fair-minded governor. And he says to the governor, you treat other things fairly. Why not us as Christians? Why do you put us on trial and accuse us without really knowing who we are? And in the second apology, he goes even further. And here we have a somewhat controversial issue, because Justin makes an attempt to show that Christian faith is not ultimately the enemy of Greek philosophy, at least not in many, many different ways the enemy of Greek philosophy. He goes so far as to suggest that the logos of John, chapter 1 and 1 John and so on, is basically similar to the logos philosophy of the Greeks. And you have, of course, in many of the Greeks, a logos doctrine, which says something like reason is unveiled to human memory when humans make themselves accessible to it. And Justin suggests that that the logos has actually come to its own in Jesus Christ. He makes a suggestion, and scholars differ on how strongly they think he really meant this, that even Socrates and Plato would have been sort of Christians without knowing it because of their logos philosophy. It's something to wrestle with. Obviously, as Reformed people and as presuppositionalists, there's something very uncomfortable about this. I think it's important to wrestle with what he's trying to do and what he's not trying to do. He's not trying to say that Greek philosophy and biblical religion are the same. He's simply trying to say, look, why do you accuse us of putting opposition to things when we're really not doing that? In the dialogue with Trypho, he shows his own conversion story, and he argues strongly, and this will become a trend in all of the early apologetics, how and why Jesus Christ is the fulfillment of the Old Testament and of prophecy. Extraordinary man, died a martyr for his faith, much to learn from, and he's considered by many the very first major apologist. He's often contrasted and compared to a second figure who is temperamentally very, very different, Tertullian. Tertullian is an extraordinary figure in his own right and will sound to us much more as though he were aware of presuppositions, because he loves to speak of opposites. Tertullian wrote an apology. He wrote pages on the Trinity. In fact, it's believed he coined the term Trinity. Tertullian could really turn a phrase. He writes very memorable phrases that have come down in the church ever since. For example, he said, the blood of the Christians is the seed of the church. And that's become, I think, a very wonderful, powerful catchword. You kill off the Christians, and to your surprise and dismay, many, many more reemerge. Martyrdom doesn't put an end to Christian faith. It actually helps it grow in some ways. Now, that's a much too simple thesis to cover all of martyrdom, but we've certainly seen that in the modern world, in Africa, in Russia, in China. Systematic attempts to expunge Christian faith have only ended in the existence, the survival, and even thriving of an underground and significant church movement. Tertullian appeals to the high antiquity of Scripture and to the majesty of Scripture. One of his major themes is that the Christian religion is true because of apostolic succession. Now, he's not saying what the Roman Catholic Church would say after Trent about apostolic succession. He's saying something quite different. He's saying that the apostolic doctrine, which was given to these witnesses by Jesus Christ, has been carried out and has been given to successive generations by apostolic leaders. And so, arguing to a culture that respects antiquity, he's kind of trying to trump that. And he's arguing against heresies that say, you know, we have a secret new thing. Because it's new, it's pretty exciting, pretty attractive. You better get with us. He's arguing against a lot of the heresies who said newness is good, that not at all. Being apostolic is what's good. And again, that carries over till today. So many of the cults and heresies will say, you know, up until such and such a leader, Joseph Smith or whoever it might be, it wasn't quite clear. But once we've got this prophet, everything really can become clear, and you better line up with this prophet. And Tertullian says, no, it's got to be apostolic. He expends much energy proving the divinity of Christ. He ultimately is a masterful apologist trying to turn non-Christian philosophy upside down. Here's one of his phrases. I think I've offered sufficient proof upon the question of false and true divinity, having shown that the proof rests not merely on debate and argument, but on the witness of the very beings whom you believe are gods. Now, he's using the propensity of many in an ancient culture to lift up extraordinary speakers and prophets as gods. And he's saying, you know, these are your gods, okay, well, here's what they say. They're talking about Christianity. One of the accusations against Christians, you get a lot of strange accusations, of course. I mean, you have things like they were accused of cannibalism because in their central ritual, which was the Lord's Supper, there was the commemoration of Christ's blood and his body. They were accused of incest, because they greeted one another across the gender lines with a holy kiss and so forth. One of the accusations was that you Christians ought to be persecuted because you keep saying you like to be persecuted. That's part of what you like. And so we'll just be your servants here. Tertullian says, in that case, you say, why do you complain of our persecutions? You ought rather to be grateful to us for giving you the suffering you want. Well, he says, it is quite true that it is our desire to suffer, but it's in the way that the soldier longs for war. No one indeed suffers willingly, since suffering necessarily implies fear and danger. And he goes on to build this analogy with the soldier. The soldier doesn't want to suffer, but he feels called to go into battle, and if he must, he will. It's something like the difference between courage and foolish suicidal ventures. One more quote, which is his most famous, of course, which is used all the time to prove that he had no interest in philosophy and saw absolutely no relationship between Christianity and philosophy, which actually turns out not to be true in his own writings. But it's this one. What has Jerusalem to do with Athens? The church with the academy? The Christian with the heretic? Our principles come from the porch of Solomon, who had himself taught that the Lord is to be sought in simplicity of heart. I have no use for a Stoic or a Platonic or a dialectic Christianity. Now, he was one of the most educated and well-versed philosophers of his time. And indeed, he knew very well how to turn an argument upside down from within philosophy. But he is giving a principle here of contrast, which I think is a complement, maybe not a contradiction, but a complement to Justin Martyr's perhaps overly simple comparison of Christian doctrines to Greek philosophy. I hope you got your seatbelts on. We're kind of moving faster. The greatest theologian, bishop, thinker, witness, and apologist in the patristic time is Augustine. Now, I'm calling him a hinge figure because he represents a transition, really, from the first period of pre-Christendom to the second of Christendom. He's one of the most beloved, as well as one of the most foundational figures in all of theology. He's beloved because he's so real. He's really a man of flesh and bones. He has feet of clay, but he's got this redoubtable spirit and mind, which has given the church much of its foundational material that we still live on. His Confessions is one of the great masterpieces of Christian literature. In it, he tells of his journey from paganism, from sex addiction, from Manichaean heresy, from just the lostness and confusion of a very talented young man who, as he said it himself, as he looked at a poor drunken beggar on the street one day, felt himself far worse off than that man, because at least that man showed what he was. And there was a sort of honesty about it, whereas he was hiding all these things in his chest. To a man of faith, his conversion story itself is worth remembering. He sat under the preaching of Ambrose of Milano and was challenged by that. And the final step of faith came when he was in a garden, and he heard some children singing a little song that said something like, "Pick this up and read it, pick this up and read it." And he did, and there was a Bible there open to Romans chapter 13, and he came to Christ. Then he became a bishop, and he wrote on every issue of theology and just stress the sovereignty of God in all things. Let me tell you one of the stories in the Confessions, because I find it so moving. He had, as many of us did at that age, and I hope still do, a best friend. And his best friend was a little younger than he was, a fellow named Alypius. And Alypius was his student during non-Christian days, and Augustine went around making money by tutoring in rhetoric and so forth. He was very good with Latin, and Alypius shared some of Augustine's problems and sins, but he had a weakness which was very very deep, and it was really an addiction. He couldn't stay away from the gladiatorial games. He had a sort of addiction to these games. And they were these bloodthirsty things where animals fought each other, animals fought men, men fought men. And he loved going to the arena and hearing the crowd and cheering them on. It's a very evil sort of entertainment that the Romans used really for various purposes, not only entertainment, but to keep people addicted to the system. And to make a very long and fascinating story short, after he comes to faith, he goes to Rome, and he vows never to go to these games again. Well, in Rome, he finds some of his old friends. This is always the way with addictions. And they tout him, and they taunt him, and they invite him back, and they say, "Come on, let's just go to one game. What's one game going to do to you? And it'll be the seal of our old friendship," and so on. So he decides to go and he says, well, I'm just going to go and close my eyes. And of course, Augustine writes, would that he had closed his ears also, because when he began to hear the crowds and the din and so forth, he opened his eyes, and then he became a cheerleader. He fell very, very far. As Augustine eloquently writes in language that could be textbook psychology, he fell harder than the fall of the victim of the games. And the sword pierced through him stronger than the sword of the gladiators. And then he adds, but you are not yet done with him, O Lord. And he goes on to tell how what Alypius needed to do, which presumably Augustine was doing at this time as well, was to move from the conceit of thinking that ancient morality, Manichaean or Greek, the high morality of the Greeks, some of it was very remarkable, could actually stand him in a good stead through a trial. He had to learn to be broken, and how Manichaean ethics couldn't do it. Only the power of Christ could make you able, through the Holy Spirit, to fulfill the law of God. And he himself went on to be a great church leader, and it's a very extraordinary story, and woven into it is an apology, an argument about the superiority of Christian faith and the whole Christian worldview over against even the best of the worldview of the ancient world. In The City of God, perhaps his masterpiece, he mounts a massive argument against paganism. It's 22 chapters long, and it's really, the title is from the Psalms. It's really a contrast of Plato's Republic. He identifies the church age with the millennium of Revelation 20, and he sees this time as a time when the church is slowly, gradually getting stronger and stronger, moving out of the city of man to the city of God, which is heaven. The occasion for the writing of this is interesting. Rome, the unthinkable had happened. Rome had been sacked by Alaric's armies. The Visigoths had come and attacked the city. These were Arian Christians from Europe. And I suppose hard for us to imagine, even the downing of the Twin Towers in New York would have been more thinkable than the foreign invasion of Rome, which was thought to be impregnable and had been for seven centuries. And when that happens, people look for a scapegoat, as, of course, we have been doing. Who do you think the scapegoat was when Rome began to crumble? Well, it was Christians. And the argument was this. Romans believed that every city and every region was protected by one or more gods. In the case of Rome, there was a pantheon of the greatest of all gods who protected the city and held it together. When Christians begin to live in the Roman Empire and in the city of Rome, they have a god who won't play ball. He won't get in, he won't want admission into the pantheon. He claims to be the creator of all. He denies the reality of these other gods. And so the gods aren't happy. They would be glad to welcome the Lord Jehovah into their fellowship, but they don't want him as somebody who claims to be better than they are, let alone their creator. So the gods cease protecting the city, and it's invaded by these heretic Christians, the Arians. Augustine answers the charge in The City of God. He says, no, it's paganism that's the fundamental problem.
This is the end of Side 1. Please flip the tape at this point.
Christians, if you will note well, are your most loyal citizens. For sure they don't believe that Caesar is God. And many of them won't burn the torch to him in order to get a job or whatever. But they are secretly more loyal and helpful to the fabric of the society than most of the pagans. They are the ones who pay their taxes. They pray for the emperor. They take care of the poor in ways that other people won't do. They take care of the poorest of the poor, the people that are just left on the street by the Roman system. And so he answers in this magnificent masterpiece of the first real Christian philosophy of history that we're marching on to the city of God. What did he see as the city of man versus the city of God? Yeah, I think some that we would heartily agree with and some that we probably would recognize as a vestige of Platonism. The city of man was, of course, the surrounding culture was the attempt to build on pagan values. The city of God was the church. Although the church wasn't quite entirely identified with the city of God and wouldn't be until the last judgment, the last day. So the church is kind of on its way to becoming more and more like the city of God and less the city of man. And so you do have a biblical idea. You know, we look to a city whose foundations are not human. But we also have this Platonic idea of climbing up the ladder. And in some of it, you'll find a very Platonic notions, such as Augustine believed that marriage was not quite as noble an estate as celibacy. He had a beloved concubine, and he had a child by this woman. And when he became a Christian, he sent her away. He loved his son, but he felt that he was more single-minded as a celibate. There was a Platonic spirituality there, which you can find, and scholars debate how much or how little it's present. But I think you'll find it there in the city of God. Yeah, good question. All right. Now, Christianity became a licit religion during Constantine's time. But of course, it only gradually became the dominant religious force in much of the East and in most of the West. There's lots of fascinating histories of this. We wrongly call the Middle Ages the Dark Ages. There was darkness in various decades, indeed. But there was often a great light that comes rushing in. I don't know if you read How the Irish Saved Civilization by Cahill. Amazing story of how this unusual people on a far-off island in Europe, because of their love of words and books, preserved biblical culture and spread it back over into Europe. And did, in some real sense, save civilization. The church became the hub of civilization with all the good that that means. Imagine the great cathedrals, or hear the great motets, see the great paintings, the icons, look at the laws that were set for trading. The hospital system for health care, the charities, and so forth. It's just an amazing time. There were renaissances within medieval times. There were technological revolutions. It's an amazing time. Of course, the downside is that there were, of course, admixtures of Christian faith with Greek philosophy and the papacy became so powerful that there was confusion between temporal power and ecclesiastical power, and we know all that ensued, giving rise to the need for the Protestant Reformation. Still, it's an extraordinary time. Philosophy became ancilla theologiae, the the ancillary, the handmaid, as it was called, of theology. It was a time of building, of construction. The church was seen as the mother of the arts. And issues like how to reason Christianly were very prominent. The university system began to grow up, Bologna and Oxford and the Sorbonne. It was a time of outreach to somewhat to the Jews, though there were sad episodes of neglect there, and also to Islam. So as you can imagine, things began to change. The goals and skills of the apologists necessarily were somewhat modified. And the first great figure at this time is Anselm of Canterbury. I'll just get to the substance here rather than retell his wonderful life story. But he can be well understood because he himself quoted from Isaiah in order to define what he believed and how he was going to approach apologetics. Fides quaerens intellectum, faith seeking understanding. In other words, he, at least in principle, believed that you didn't begin with reasonable contentions, logical proofs, evidence, and so forth, and then hope that Christianity passed the test. You begin from belief, and then you build your case for why it is you believe. Now, some of us would argue that he wasn't altogether successful here, but again, we have to remember that this was early in the history of the development of theology, and they didn't have the advantage of hindsight that we do. His lasting achievement is Cur Deus Homo, why God became man. And in this book, he sets forth a theory of the atonement, which eventually would be something like the substitutionary theory. In fact, it was based on honor. Honor was broken and shamed by sin. And in order to regain God's honor, but to be reconciled to him with our own honor intact, there had to be a vicarious atonement. There had to be suitable restoration of honor by the atonement. Now, in apologetics, his best known work is the Proslogion. And at the heart of the Proslogion is a controversial argument which, if you've taken any philosophy, you will have encountered, because it's one of the major types of classical or theistic proofs. And it's become known as the ontological argument. Now, it goes like this. Now, forgive me for the apparent opaqueness of this. You're certainly not going to be responsible for it in any test or anything. But this gives you a sense of how he was arguing. Step number one, God is that than which nothing greater can be conceived. And that's his famous phrase, that than which recurs over and over again. He quotes Psalm 14 and says, even the fool knows this, because he's saying there is no God, but he's got to say God to say that. Second, this reality exists in our understanding. Third, but if he is that than which nothing greater can be conceived, and because reality is greater than our understanding, therefore, step number four, he exists. Or to quote him, so truly therefore dost thou exist, O Lord my God, that thou canst not be conceived not to exist. Okay, brings tears to your eyes, right? No, It's one of those arguments that, in a way, you see the holes in it. And he had debates almost immediately with people like Gaunilo and others. Yes, but I can conceive of pink elephants, you know. That doesn't mean that they exist. But he was a smart man, and he knew that pink elephants were not the same as that than which. I am of two minds about this proof. Basically, I think there's a fundamental problem with it, which is that though he says faith begets understanding, he begins here not from faith, but from a an internal logical argument, a sort of giant deduction from something that seems like an immutable truth. And he gets to the reality of it that way. And I just don't think you want to do that as a coercive demonstration. However, in an informal sort of way, and even Cornelius Van Til noted this about the proof, there is a parallel here to Romans 1. Romans 1 tells us we have a sense of divinity. We have a sense of deity, which won't go away. We try to suppress it, and it's there. And we know that there's something outside of our own being which corresponds to this sense. So if you want, and this is the way some people like Karl Barth and others have handled it, you could see it as a sort of a very medieval way of arguing presuppositionally. Alvin Plantinga, one of the leading philosophers of the day, perhaps America's greatest philosopher, uses this argument, or uses forms of it in his own way of arguing. So it's an amazing thing. His bishop wasn't too happy with him when he decided to set off proving Christianity without the Bible. And Anselm said, yeah, but you know, you ought to be able to do that if it's true for everyone. And people have pointed out, furthermore, that this is set in the midst of a prayer rather than a philosophical treatise. That's why it's, O Lord, my God, you can't be conceived not to exist in there. It's actually almost a liturgical proof. So there's something quite amazing about this, even though fundamentally I think we've got a problem. The great figure of the Middle Ages is Thomas Aquinas. Again, I wish I could tell you about his life story. On the surface, it's actually fairly ordinary. He moved from one university to another and wrote books. But some of us find that to be a very romantic existence. And he did a lot more than that. He was an amazing man. He discovered or rediscovered much Greek philosophy thanks to Jewish and Islamic translators who took the original texts and translated them into Latin. He was a great student and a great teacher. And his two most magisterial works, among his many others, are known under the Latin name of Summa. This is not a form of wrestling. This is a way of saying we have covered a body of material. He wrote the Summa Theologiae, which is a sum of theology. And it's the great masterpiece of theological doctrinal reasoning in the High Middle Ages, and indeed stands today as one of the great masterpieces of theology. He also wrote the Summa Contra Gentiles, and that's a fascinating book because it was conceived first as a missions manual to help with Islamic missions. Two things need to be said about his apologetics, even though so much could be said about his theology. The first is that he set out to reason for the Christian faith based on what he thought were the common acceptable rules of reason. And most of these came almost directly from Aristotle, who is a kind of mentor for him. He calls him the philosopher throughout his works. And they are things like the law of non-contradiction, excluded middle, and all of Aristotle's sort of edifice of reason and dialectic. And he set out to do this because he said, if you're arguing with Muslims, for example, you can't very well argue from scripture because they don't believe scripture. But everyone believes or has to use the laws of reason. And so we'll start with that. And we can prove a number of things from reason. We can prove the existence of God. We can prove that he was the creator, that we are creatures, and so forth. Second, in order to prove that, he, again taking from Aristotle, had another kind of proof, which is not the ontological proof, but we call it the cosmological proof. It has five varieties. I'll only give you one or two, because they're very similar. The five varieties all begin with something earthly and move back to the need for something eternal. They are motion, efficient cause, contingency, gradation, and purpose. Let me just give you one example, motion. I'm going to go rapidly here because there's more subtlety in the argument than you'll get from this summary, but here's the essence of it. In the world, you have motion. Everything is in motion. One kind of motion is neighbor to another, begets another. There's a sort of flux. And this can happen in lots of ways, physical ways, historical ways, and so on. However, said Thomas, motion cannot exist independently. There has to be, in order for it all to work, an unmoved mover. The same with cause and effect. He said in the world, everything is an effect of a cause. But you cannot regress infinitely in a chain of cause and effect. There must be a first cause, and we call him God. And after that, he went on to say, but there are truths that can only be understood by revelation, such as grace, the atonement, and so forth. Now again, huge problems here, and Thomas and Aristotle were probably the backdrop in contrast to which much of the Reformation occurred. Obviously, there's a problem saying that if you can't go to a Muslim with the Bible because they don't believe it, well, that's what unbelief is. You argue against unbelief at every level, including your mind. There is a noetic effect of sin. There is a sinfulness of thinking, which affects our ability to reason. And so people aren't even using the laws of reason correctly, if those indeed are the right laws, because of sin. Now, you've got to begin arguing your case from revelation and ask the Holy Spirit to do the rest. On the other hand, there is something, again going back to Romans 1, of a parallel here to the way Paul and the apostles argue. The world is contingent. There's something dependent out here. You can see it. The trees need the sun, and we need rain, and you need mom and dad to bring you up, and so forth. It stands to reason, sanctified spiritual reason, that there be a cause behind all this, a creator. And so there's something to this this argument, strength and weakness. The irreducible complexity people are using something like a Thomistic argument in arguing from creation. On that suggestion, I will leave you, and we'll meet again on Friday.